Today's program on Veterans Radio is dedicated to those men who fled Europe prior to World War II and returned as U.S. soldiers. The rich boys.
Live from the Veterans Radio Studios on the Ave Maria Network, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here is your host for today's program, former CB, Gary Lilly.
And good morning around the world. This is Gary Lilly, former CB, Chu Lai, Vietnam, 1966. And I'm sitting in the studio today with former Slick pilot Dale Thronberry.
And good morning. Yes, CW2 type Thronberry, 195th Assault Helicopter Company, Republic of Vietnam, 1969.
And so Dale was over there just flying around, admiring the scenery and looking into places like Cambodia. Oh, that had to be fun.
It was fun. Flying on top of the clouds was probably the biggest thrill I ever had. I was talking to somebody the other day. It was like a magic carpet ride. You get up on top of the clouds, and it's like you were sitting in an easy chair just looking around. That was the fun part.
Yeah, I never thought about it before. That I was kidding, of course, about the flying around having fun. But all that bubble glass in front of you and looking down, that had to be a magnificent view.
It was. It was. And I bet you could ask all the infantry guys that we gave rides to that would sit on the edge of the skids and just look down there. I wonder how many of us will get up on our roofs now.
I know. You see photographs of these guys. And, in fact, when they're coming into LZs, especially if it's hot, standing on those skids from mm-hmm. quite a height, yeah, you're right. How many would get on a roof? What an amazing time in history. Even then I knew it was historic times over and above any other historic times.
Well, I think, you know, it turns out we're learning as we've been doing this program for 7 years almost now, all the amazing experiences that the men and women have that are in the military that we can't comprehend at the time. And because we're so young and, you know, and nothing's ever going to happen to us, and then we find out that stuff does, unfortunately. Yeah. But you meet the most amazing people.
You're absolutely right. And we're going to be talking to one of those amazing people today, Guy Stern, who is a distinguished professor at Wayne State University in Michigan. And he is also connected with the Jewish Holocaust Museum. That's not the formal name. We'll have to ask him about it. But Guy Stern is one of what is known as the Ritchie Boys. And by the way, if there are any Ritchie Boys out there and would like to phone in, our number here at Veterans Radio is 877-573-7825. We're coming to you on the Ave Maria Radio Network from our home studio in WDEO Radio here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And again, that number is 877-573-7825. We'll be talking to Guy Stern. These guys came from Europe. They fled the Nazis and worked in our U.S. military, served the country in a very, very special role. And there's a great documentary, The Ritchie Boys. I don't know where you can get it, but Guy Stern will tell us. It's just a tremendous documentary, so fascinating. But what I loved is these guys had this dry sense of humor, mm-hmm. and I was laughing all the way through it because if you listen carefully, you'd pick up their little one-liners and some of the interesting things that they did.
I want to thank Mark Lindke, who's from Ann Arbor, for providing us with this DVD and telling us about this operation because we had never heard of it. Obviously, a lot of other people have not either. But we're going to make sure that the rest of the world knows all about the Ritchie Boys within an hour.
Within an hour, right. And I only learned of it a few days ago. So this is special. And I've talked to the guy, Stern, and he's a neat guy. I just enjoyed talking to him. You'll enjoy listening to him. Dale, do you have anything else that you want to cover before we get into this? Any announcements? Or you know what? let's talk again just for a minute about U.S. Wings down there in Hudson, Ohio. They're the guys that hosted us and put on the 50th anniversary rally for Vietnam veterans. This is 50 years since the Vietnam War started. It only seems like 45 to me because it was 5 years old when I was there. But what a tremendous time, and what a Sarge Hack, what a great guy he is. He's the founder, CEO of U.S. Wings, terribly wounded over in Vietnam, and went on to make a successful life, devout Catholic, and built that business on ethics. Was it pretty amazing that the product that he has?
I think it's an amazing program that he's got going down there, not in addition to his business, but that whole area of Ohio is so veteran-friendly that it was a great experience for all of us to go down there and do the program. And Sergeant Hack is going to be receiving the final edited copies of our program in the next couple of days, and it is available now. If you're interested in getting a copy of that program with all the external extraneous stuff taken out of the program, you can just contact us and we'll make sure you get one. But I want to thank Henry Root for putting the program together and editing it down. It's fantastic, and the CD is just so impressive.
It looks good. It's so great. I've not ever seen a CD that looked like that before. Very, very proud of it, and in awe of Henry Root. U.S. Wings, uswings.com. Their toll-free number, by the way, is 800-650-0659. But go to www.uswings.com, and you better watch your checkbook because you're going to want to buy some of that great...
The most amazing gear.
Oh, I got one of the leather coats while I was down there. They're suppliers of flight jackets to the U.S. military, the Australian Air Force, the New Zealand Air Force, Hollywood, so many others. Who was it?
John Travolta. Evidently, I remember somebody throwing the name John Travolta around, and Gary Sinise and some of the other ones that have got these jackets now.
Yep. The one that John Travolta is wearing in his that ad in front of his airplane, that's a U.S. Wings jacket.
Oh, okay.
And Jim Belushi bought 500 of them for gifts for his friends. Eric Clapton bought 400 of them. They ain't cheap. But I did get a real good special on that leather jacket. It was the Daily Special. One jacket. I spotted it. That's mine.
Good deal. We're anxiously looking forward to going back there next year.
It will be fun. Neat town to stay in, too. Okay. We're going to be taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Guy Stern, one of the Ritchie Boys of World War II. And right now, we want to welcome home all of those great troops that are defending our country all over the world. And troops, we admire you. We just think that you're the best. And we want to say from Veterans Radio to you, welcome home.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Mopping up soda pop Rickies to our heart's delight.
Jukebox Saturday night, the sisters,
the Andrew Sisters?
Andrew Sisters, right. How could I forget that name? That's synonymous with World War II. This morning, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking to distinguished Wayne State University, Michigan professor Guy Stern, who will be telling us about the Ritchie Boys and also the upcoming symposium, reunion, and the Jewish Holocaust Museum. He'll be giving us the correct name. And Veterans Radio wants to say good morning to Guy Stern.
Good morning, Mr. Liddy.
How are you this morning?
To you. I'm well and ready to talk.
I don't know. You probably heard a saying. I just love your sense of humor. You've got the greatest smile. It's showing on our webcast right now, and you're just you're a happy guy. It seems like.
Yes, I feel fulfilled. I quit teaching. I was retired after 50 years of teaching. And enjoyed almost every moment of that activity.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you immigrated from Europe prior to World War II. Tell us a little bit about that. Why did you leave Europe, and where did you end up when you got here?
Yes, I lived in a northern town in Germany, Hildesheim, and as every part of Germany, it was taken over by one of the most evil spirits of this and past centuries, by the rise of National Socialism, the rise of Hitler, and the pogroms that followed. So I left Germany with the help of an uncle in St. Louis, and in 1937 I came to St. Louis as a refugee from Nazi Germany.
You were one of the fortunate ones, and there were a number of fortunate ones, but there was a lot of unfortunate that couldn't get out of the country. When you arrived here in the States, what did you do the first years? And how old were you?
I was 15 years old, and 5 days after arriving in St. Louis, I was sitting at a high school, Soldan High School in St. Louis, and was faced with a test in mathematics.
I assume you were a good student because you're a pretty smart guy. Did you have a hard time adjusting? Could you speak English at that time?
Yes. My parents had retained a German coach who had lived for many years in the United States and, in fact, was a teacher at an orphanage in Brooklyn, but I don't think I acquired a Brooklyn accent.
No, I guess you didn't. The southern, eastern Brooklyn, maybe. As a 15-year-old, did you fully comprehend what was going on back there, and how difficult was it for you to leave your family?
I deluded myself, to answer your last question, that we would soon be reunited, that we could all immigrate, and that didn't happen, and my family perished in the Holocaust. But as far as my adjustment was concerned, this teacher and my teachers in high school had greatly prepared me for the American adventure, and I really fell right into it. I substituted my enthusiasm for European soccer by becoming a baseball fan.
Ah, that may, you're a real. Do you like hot dogs too?
Well, we had popsicles in the Sportsman's Park in St. Louis.
Okay, a lot healthier for you.
Cardinals,
right? Yeah, the Cardinals.
It was the Cardinals and a team that some of you younger folks may not know, the St. Louis Browns.
Oh, I remember them.
Okay.
Yes. At any rate, what was your favorite memory prior to World War II breaking out?
You mean of Germany or of my growing up in St. Louis?
Yeah, I was thinking of your growing up in St. Louis.
It was a wonderful high school, as good as many of the prep schools that I later on encountered. And my second memory, after graduating from high school and working for 1 year, I enrolled at St. Louis University, which is a Jesuit university, and I have fond memories of those absolutely magnificent teachers that we had at St. Louis U. And I must say, in my teaching career, I often emulated those fathers I had at St. Louis U.
What a compliment. When things were developing over in Europe, getting very bad, I assumed you followed it very closely?
Absolutely, because I was concerned, worried, upset what might have happening to my family.
What was when the war broke out and Germany declared war on the United States after Pearl Harbor? What were your inklings? What did you feel? Did you have a feeling that you wanted to do something?
Yes, absolutely. At St. Louis U, there were posters. If you had language and cultural proficiency, that Navy intelligence would be was looking for people so qualified. And in fact, I went down to the Naval Recruiting Section and asked whether I could join the intelligence. When they detected my German accent, which wasn't difficult, they said no. At this time, they were only taking native-born Americans. So later on, a couple of months later, I received my draft notice and was inducted into the military, in the Army.
And you took basic training at what camp was it?
That was at Camp Barkley, Texas, in Abilene, Texas.
Okay, and well, they got an accent of their own down there. You must have fit in well.
I tried to emulate that one, too.
So, can you say howdy in Texan?
Howdy, stranger, yes.
All right, then you got orders to a place called Fort Ritchie. Tell us about that.
Yes, at that time it was named Camp Ritchie. I was called to company headquarters one day, and the first sergeant turned me over to the commanding lieutenant, and they said, Private Stern, you're shipping out. And I said, sir, may I ask where to? And he said, no, you may open your orders when you're 3 hours on the train. We're putting you on the train. And then I found out that I was going to Camp Ritchie, Maryland, not knowing what really was awaiting me. And then when I got finally to Camp Ritchie, standing in Baltimore to a Toonerville kind of train, and then to trucks, and there I was, and it said on the entrance of the camp, it said, Military Intelligence Training Center.
Top secret, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it kind of made you think, if it was so top secret, why advertise?
When you talked about that in that great DVD, great documentary, The Ritchie Boys, I laughed out loud. We're talking to Professor Guy Stern, who is a former Ritchie boy, one of the amazing people that fled Europe and served in the U.S. Army over in Europe. They returned to Europe to gather intelligence and to perform psychological warfare, or consult on psychological warfare, I guess is one of the ways to describe it. But tell us what your school was like, and tell us about the kind of people that were there. I loved that description.
I would say about 80% of the soldiers who were being trained at Camp Ritchie were something like me, about my age, coming from Europe as refugees, some of them older and already established and quite well known. There were two authors who had written best-selling novels. It was an intellectually challenging group of people that you were surrounded with. Well, of course, I had only passed my sophomore courses in college, but these people really challenged you to think your best. The courses that you asked me about were the most intense I've ever taken, even as I was preparing later on for my doctorate and special courses such as that. At Ritchie, you were trained in every phase of intelligence work, such as interrogating prisoners of war, learning to read aerial maps, learning to listen to Morse code, being proficient at identifying German army uniforms. In fact, you were to learn the whole organization of German army units and of Italian army units. I could go on with the curriculum, and it was absolutely intense from morning to evening, and you better absorbed it if you wanted to stay within that unit.
And the alternative, I guess, was to be put as a rifleman, and one of many. I assume that you had a feeling that you were in a greater role than even the average soldier.
Well, that I would relativize. Each one of us, whether you were in the infantry and artillery or whatever, it was a generation that tried to do its best. So I have the greatest respect for the frontline troops that made it possible for us in the intelligence to function.
And I've always said that I am in awe of the grunt, as they were called in Vietnam, and since, I guess, the grunt, the frontline soldier, the mud slogger, the foot soldier, the guy that gets it done on the ground, I'm in awe of them, just in awe of them. You saw them, and I saw them, and I'll never forget it. When I talk to students, I'll say, you'll never comprehend what they did because I saw it and I don't comprehend it. So, go ahead.
You know, what was so surprising was the matter-of-fact way all of the soldiers did their duty. I worked with one of the members of the Ranger Battalion that had spearheaded the invasion at Omaha Beach. Kid named Mickey. I don't know much about him beyond that. And he was nonchalant. He had just gone through one of the most harrowing invasion practices in the history of military. And he was nonchalant and was laughing as he was guarding and commanding the prisoners we had. And I have great admiration for people like that. And since you talked of Ohio, the ranking non-com of the guard unit, of the military police unit, was Sergeant Hadley of Steubenville, Ohio. And he was tough, and I'm sure that in civilian life he was the sweetest guy, but when he took command of the prisoners, there was no nonsense.
And you did a lot of role-playing with actual German prisoners at Camp Ritchie?
At Camp Ritchie, we had certain SOP ways of interrogating prisoners. One of them was that you never touched a prisoner, that you used your head in order to extract information. That was the training at Ritchie, but we sort of refined it in the field. One of the things that Ritchie had taught us was you play on the prisoner's greatest expectations, desires, interests on the one hand, and you use on their greatest anxieties and fears on the other. So that's where my role playing came in. I teamed up with a friend of mine who was also in our theater of operation, a fellow by the name of Fred Howard from New York, and he played the soft-hearted American when confronted by a recalcitrant prisoner who wouldn't talk, and I played a role that was really, I called for a disguise. I disguised myself with uniform parts taken from liberated Russians and some trophies taken from German prisoners. I disguised myself as a Russian commissar. And the greatest fear the Germans had, the German soldiers, possibly as victims of their own propaganda, was that they would come and get into Russian captivity. So Fred, after getting no information, would say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I have to turn you over to our Russian liaison officer for shipment to Russia." And that liaison officer was named Commissar Krukov, and that was me in disguise. My tent had a three-language sign on it, Commissar Krukov, liaison officer, with a picture of Comrade Stalin in the tent, in my interrogation tent, which, of course, was signed by Commissar, by Comrade Stalin, alias Corporal Kersnes, one who, in our ranks, who knew Russian. So we really played on that fear, and when you said that we used that, yes, that was a very effective way of getting information on highly desired points of knowledge that our higher headquarters wanted.
And obviously, we have graduated from Camp Fritchie at this point and moved into the field in Europe. You went in on D-Day, but before we talk about D-Day, I want to tell you, I knew a German soldier. He belonged to an Elks Club I belonged to. He was on the Eastern Front, and he said the happiest day of his life was when they got transferred to the Western Front. And they, towards the end of the war, the number one topic of conversation amongst them was how they hoped they would be captured by the Americans and not the Russians. So,
absolutely right. I want to amend something you just said. I was ordered to come in on D plus three. Some of our unit came in on D plus one. One friend of mine who had volunteered for the parachutes, he parachuted minus a couple of hours prior to H hour. So we were scattered across the invasion. My own orders were D plus three.
And so for the civilians, HR, it was the moment of invasion by water. The paratroopers went in prior to HR. D plus one would be the day after D-Day. D plus three would be 3 days after D-Day. Am I correct on that?
Yes, you got it absolutely right.
Okay, great. And so we're about a minute and a half left in this segment. Tell us what your impression was the very first day that you were, when you arrived on D-Day on the Normandy beachhead.
My impression was one of internal fear. And I have to admit to that, and I don't think I was any different from any of the soldiers on that PT boat. We didn't know what would await us on shore. And, of course, my fear was intensified by the fact that if I were captured by the Nazis, I don't think I would have gotten preferential treatment. And finally, I was scared of myself because I had always been squeamish in life. And if you saw the corpses and the desiccated corpses on shore, I was afraid I would I might pass out. As a matter of fact, when I got on the beach and I saw
Professor. We're going to have to come back. We're going to have to come back to that matter of fact. All right, we're taking a break right now. We'll be right back right after these messages.
The Medal of Time by a Japanese bullet. Instantly placing himself in the direct line of fire, he shielded the fallen Marine with his own body and staunchly continued his treatment, although constantly menaced by the slashing fury of shrapnel and bullets falling on all sides. Alert, determined, and completely unselfish in his concern for the helpless Marine, he persevered in his efforts until he himself sustained mortal wounds and collapsed, heroically sacrificing himself that his comrade might live. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Sisters, and it's the music of Professor Guy Stern's era, World War II. I'm sorry, Professor. You were in there, and you were talking about your first reactions.
That is right, and there's only one sentence to be added to that. Once I was on the beach, the fears left me because there was one of my friends who had already started interrogating prisoners on D+1, and he shouted at me, "Hey, Stern, get over here. We got too many prisoners." So I found myself at an improvised table made out of crates. I was sitting there, and in front of me was a tough artillery sergeant, and I had a second anxiety, not fear, because this sergeant refused to answer any of my questions using that shield of just being required by the Geneva Convention to give his name, rank, and serial number, and an accident happened. A shell came over. We both hit the dirt. And since probably because of my inexperience, I got up first, I saw him still on the ground, and I shouted at him, "Get up!" And he did. And he was cowed by the fact that I had gotten up first, and all of a sudden the situation changed. I got the information that I was supposed to extract from him, and from that day on, I interrogated, adjusting to the prisoners from the beaches until we stopped interrogating on Victory Europe Day.
Tell us what information you were looking for when you were interrogating prisoners.
Yes, there were two types. When we first arrived at the beaches, it was all tactical information. Where were those howitzers firing from? The mortars. Where was the 116th division stationed? How were they deployed? In other words, really hard information which our G1 could use in deploying our own troops.
Who was G1?
G1 is the tactical highest officer at 1st U.S. Army, who was in charge under the command of General Courtney Hodges to order attacks or tactical deployment of U.S. troops.
And you were in G2 intelligence, is that correct?
And we were served under, ultimately under Colonel Dixon, who was the G2 of 1st U.S. Army, and we reported directly, our commanding officer reported to a colonel under the command of Colonel Dixon.
Okay, thank
and
you.
And the information they wanted later on was strategic, and that meant long-range plans that our G2 and our headquarters could arrive at. And they needed information ranging from targets for our Air Force to the German supply lines, their ability to launch counterattacks. We got questionnaires, and we got assigned to interrogate on the strength of enemy divisions and new divisions that were arriving at our front.
Tell us about the prisoners that you interrogated. Were there the very tough ones, like you talked about with the artillery officer, to those that were mentally and morally beaten?
Yes. There were many who, on the model of that first prisoner I ever interrogated, that artillery sergeant. And on the other hand, we also had German prisoners who were opposed to Nazism and who were able to desert at a convenient place, and that was to encourage them. That was part of psychological warfare in which we also participated. And finally, there were some who simply were tired of war, were beaten, and wanted to get out of the war, like that soldier you described earlier in the program.
What different tactics would you use if you had a tough person and if you had the beaten person and the one who was anti-Nazi? You didn't use the same strategy on all three of them, I assume.
That is correct. The toughest interrogation was targets, because you could not use any deception or dream up a scenario that would fool him. Because if you asked about landmarks for a factory or asked at what capacity that factory was still working after one of our bombing attacks, even the dumbest prisoner would know what you were after. So that was when we called on Commissar Krukov, meaning me, and me putting on a Russian accent in my German to make it appear more plausible. But sometimes, or frequently, a buddy-buddy approach worked. I said I had been a soccer fan. So one day I had a prisoner who seemed very promising with information. He had been a company clerk, and so much information passed through his hands. And I said to him, "Oh, you come from Düsseldorf. Well, I'm glad I get to talk to you, because I'm a soccer fan and I like your team, Fortuna Düsseldorf, and I want to know something. You're at mid-season, your team was on top of the ranks, and now you're slowly dwindling down. What's going on?" So he told me all sorts of details, you know, about draft of some star players and all that sort of thing. And then I talked soccer with him for a while and slowly drifted into the type of information I really wanted to get from him, and it worked. And that was simply as a sample of what you could do, and the prisoner forgot that you were the enemy, and just considered you another soccer fan, and you talked. He talked freely, and I got a fairly good report out of that.
That's tremendous. That's a great story, a great example. And the one with the tough guy when you, out of inexperience, jumped up first after the artillery round. How would you handle the very, very tough guys? I mean, they weren't all that same way.
No, and I must say, in some cases we failed, but that was rare. Another way of convincing prisoners who were reluctant to talk was to show superior knowledge. In short, we had a help meet as a research center in Washington. They had found out the composition of German divisions that were likely to face us. It was called the Order of Battle Book. And that gave us a breakdown of the various regiments, frequently down to battalion commanders. So I would pretend that I knew everything anyway, and it was stupid for the prisoner to defy me, and that was a tactic not only used by me but by most of us, that we overwhelmed him. We would say, well, one time I said there was a Captain Wolf in charge of a company, and he had the foible of having a soldiers polish his boots, and his command was, polish them so hard that I can see my mirror image in it. So I started a conversation one day when I knew this soldier came from that outfit. Well, did you have to polish boots today for Captain Wolf this morning? And he looked at me as though I was clairvoyant. And that went easy after that. So showing the prisoner that you knew a hell of a lot anyway, he would be compliant.
He would be mentally defeated at that moment.
Yes.
We're coming up on the last couple of minutes of this segment. We're into it, as a matter of fact. You have a reunion coming up. Tell us a bit about that and where it will take place.
Right. I'm in charge of the Institute of the Righteous within the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, the Zeckerman Family Campus. That's on Orchard Lake Road. And our director, Mr. Goldman, has conceived the idea that we would have an exhibit on the Ritchie Boys because so many of them were affected by the Holocaust. And so we have been gathering materials, papers, photographs, artifacts, weapons that will demonstrate our work and the opposition we had.
And
the
you're looking
Nazi
for
opposition.
You're looking for former Ritchie Boys. We've got 45 seconds left, but we're heard in at least four different states on stations, and we're heard all around the country on the internet. Is there a website for this, Mr. Cern?
Yes, they can contact me at AD, as in David, 5422@gmail.com. That's my email address, and I would love to hear those we have not identified yet.
And when we come back from the break, we're going to give that email address again. We're talking to Guy Stern, who was one of the former Ritchie Boys, now a distinguished professor emeritus. We'll be right back right after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive.
And we're back on Veterans Radio talking to Guy Stern, one of the former Ritchie Boys, the people that fled Europe and served the country in the U.S. Army and intelligence. My pause was, there was actually an American that you were with. Tell us about him.
There were several Americans in our outfit who had learned German either by their environment or in school and were fluent enough to do psychological warfare and prisoners of war interrogation. One of them was, in fact, for a while, my commanding officer, Captain Rust from Brownsville, Texas. And Brownsville, as I understand it, was populated by many German immigrants during the past century and beyond. And he spoke excellent German. And in fact, then he was the commander of our Team 41 at the Western Front. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was going to ask his name.
Captain Rust, R-U-S-T.
Okay.
And he came from Brownsville, Texas, and was a very fine commander, and his German was excellent.
Guy, give us your email address again, please.
Yes. It is A-D, as in David, 5422 at Gmail, G as in George, at gmail.com.
Terrific. And we're going to have that available, too. If people miss it on this program, they can come to veteransradio.net and pick it up. Either it'll be on the website or you can email Dale at veteransradio.net. And so do you say that you do have a website? Not an email address, but a website for your July 24th reunion?
Yes. Not for the reunion itself, but the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan, does have a website. I don't know it by heart, but it is easily as attainable.
Do a Google search on it, and you'll come up with it, I'm sure, quite quickly. Let's talk about some of the guys that you served with or that were members of the Ritchie Boys. What about Fred Howard?
Fred Howard was a very enterprising fellow. He had served with OSS previously, and then came as a replacement to our unit. Possibly he's best known to the general public because of his after-the-war activities. He, after some apprenticeship, founded the largest display company in the United States and probably worldwide. It was called Howard Displays. His name, of course, was not Fred Howard. Some of us Americanized our names. And just as an example, he had designed that watch, the Timex watch ad, where a watch is being hit underwater in an aquarium, by a little hammer to show that it is waterproof and shockproof. He became very prominent in his field.
And a lot of the Ritchie boys, because of the high level of intelligence of you guys, earlier what I was driving at when you were in classrooms, regular GIs would have talk about food, sports, girls, and all that. You guys were talking psychology, arts, music, food, different kind of food. But I found that very, very interesting. You also had a fellow, Cy, was it pronounced Lewin?
Lewin.
Lewin.
Way, yes. He became a very prominent artist, and his main subject has been war. He did sketches right while he was still on the invasion boat of what he saw, and some of them were preserved. And later on, he was there when we liberated a concentration camp, and he drew sketches of those horrors. And in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in recognition of his artistry, the people opened a museum and dedicated it to him, and it's called the Cy Lewin Museum, and it's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
And that one, I assume, we can find by doing a Google search, and our staff has already come up with the Holocaust website, and that's www.holocaustcenter.org. Holocaustcenter.org.
I should have known that.
Well, we'll give Matt and Kai a couple of minutes, and they'll come up with just about anything. Tell which one of the Ritchie boys wanted to stay in Paris, rented a flat, and was looking for a girlfriend. I found that humorous.
That was now a very distinguished professor at Princeton University, Professor Brombert, Victor Brombert. And he was really picked for a dual reason. His German was flawless, but he also had lived in Paris for a long time prior, long time exaggerated as a youngster, in Paris prior to the war, and was native perfect in French. So he thought that Paris, after it was liberated, would be a long-term stop for him. Disappointed, he found out that he was also known as a German prisoner interrogator, was shipped to the front again, and was escaped, but barely, during the Hürtgen Forest German counterattack during the end of 1944 and beginning of 45.
And
that is Victor Brombert.
And in the documentary, I was a little bit shocked when I learned about the intelligence prior to the Battle of the Bulge. Tell us about that.
Yes. We had a narrow escape ourselves, our unit, attached to 1st Army Headquarters. We were ordered to take an escape route going to the south of France, and the road that we took led over the Belgian town of Eupen, E-U-P-E-N. If we had taken the other route to Malmedy, we would have run into the Malmedy massacre by the German SS General Sepp Dietrich, and many of and some of us were killed during that massacre.
My uncle was one that helped. He was a ranger at D-Day, and then he also helped pick up the bodies that were frozen stiff at the Malmedy massacre. We've got 2 minutes left, and thing that I was referring to was you guys actually picked up interrogation that there was a massive buildup of German troops and divisions, and the information was dismissed as not being factual.
That is correct. Virtually all of us who were interrogating those frontline troops were able to elicit the information that a massive counterattack was being planned, supported by troops that for that purpose had been transferred from the Russian front to the Western front. So they were a very dangerous and well-trained group of soldiers that were opposing us at the Ardennes Forest.
Professor Guy Stern, former Ritchie boy, my gosh, we've run out of time. We haven't even been able to get into your feelings when you went back to your home country and saw it. Perhaps we can have you on sometime in the future to talk about that, because it is such an important part of your story. But we want to thank you for being on Veterans Radio today. And in the future, maybe we can have you tell about some of your own thoughts that I haven't covered here today. Next week, we're going to have back Paul Petritus, who was in the Korean War, in the early days of the Korean War, when our troops were just being clobbered awful, taken prisoner, escaped, and what a remarkable story of Paul Petritus. And until that time, just think about those Ritchie boys. They were special. And you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on this program reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.